My name is Jürgen Schaffner-Bielich, and I'm a professor in theoretical astrophysics and theoretical physics. And we will have a tough schedule, so lots of topics actually are part of this lecture. But first of all, we set up the exercises. So the lectures are Thursday 10 to 12 and Thursday 10 to 11. In this room, exercises are scheduled Thursday 11 to 12, also this room. You will have just one exercise group. I think this fits. And you will find all the exercise sheets and additional information about the lecture on the e-learning platform. If you go on to our common webpage at astro.uni-frankfurt.de, you'll find the link to this lecture. Yeah, you go under lectures, and then you find compact star physics, and then you find the link to the e-learning system. Has anybody seen this webpage already? Yeah? Some of you, not all of you. Okay. Yeah. So, any questions about the general outline? So this will be a 3+1. So it will give, I think I will give 5 credit points. So it's 3+1, 5 credit points. Actually, yeah. So it counts 5 credit points. Yeah, and we will discuss how you get the credit points in the exercises. You have to attend basically all the exercises too. You can at most miss 2, and you have to do at least 2 of the exercises, yeah, on the blackboard. Good. Any questions about the setup of the lecture? No? As you can see, also the lectures will be videotaped. As soon as I have it, I will put up a link to the e-lectures onto the e-learning platform, maybe also onto the web page so you can easily find it. Otherwise, you can just look up the e-lecture platform and search under compact star physics. You should also find it. Good. So let's start with...
Just a short question.
Yeah?
The e-learning course does not have a direct access, so you have to write a little essay, I think, and send it, and then be accepted in order to be into...
That's right. So... That's right. So
do you have to write something, or is it just a...
Yes, yes. As you say, so if you wanna sign up for the e-learning platform, you have to inquire permission. So you have to write a short essay, and then if the essay is sufficient, you get granted. I mean, I also grant access if you don't write a single word,
I'm gonna copy paste,
which has happened. So, but you can also write something. Yeah, that's actually a good point, because usually before I start a lecture, I ask the students what they expect, what they think is compact star physics, and where they are standing, which semester they are, either bachelor students or master students or PhD students. So let's make a small round. Maybe I first want to state that this lecture will be given in English, if this is okay with you. Yeah. Or do you want to have the lecture given in German? No, okay. Good. Okay, that was a quick decision, sorry. Okay, I should have waited some more minutes. Okay. Good, so who's a bachelor student? Just raise your hands quickly. And who's a master student? Okay, 50-50 about, so maybe. So what is your expectation about the lecture? What do you want to have seen covered, or what you think is compact star physics about? Maybe we start here from...
Mainly Newton stars, equation of space, white dwarfs, maybe a little bit of black holes.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. more theoretical side. Because last semester I attended a lecture from Roman Gold in San Francisco. which was also about this topic, but they didn't go that much into the theoretical detail, or not as much as I would have thought.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes, I think I'm very similar to Cedric there. I heard the lecture of Roman Gold and Christian Fromm last semester, but I thought it was interesting, but it wasn't enough. I wanted more theoretical details, so
mm-hmm.
that's why I attend this lecture right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just I hope to get a basic understanding of what compact stars are, how they are functioning, and what like how they can exist. These I think strange objects. The more I think about it, the stranger they appear, and also to get some basic understanding of the topic for my bachelor thesis.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice to hear about white dwarfs, neutron stars, and black holes, and what keeps them together, and what kind of strange physics are around them.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say that this will not be recorded, so the microphone only records my voice,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not going to repeat what you're saying, so you're safe, right? The students will not be recorded. What the students are saying will not be recorded. I think it's barely audible. Yeah, just.
I expect to learn a lot about the limits, like the limits and extremes of physics. Like it's a quite extreme topic, compact stars. We're working a lot with stuff we don't really. We can kind of approximate, but we still don't know how it exactly works. So learning more about that is always interesting.
We just have an introduction round, so we want to know what you expect from the course, what topics you think are interesting,
and
could be part of the lecture. Shall we skip? Okay. Yeah.
I'm just curious, and I expect some kind of overview about compact stars.
Mm-hmm.
Some deeper level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's about describing compact stars like neutron stars or reserves and from a theoretical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't have much reason, I just think it's interesting.
Well, like those two, I'm mainly here for more, and I think it would be very interesting to talk about quasars, pulsars, and maybe some alternate gravity theories, because I know most of the people here might have heard GR, but there's more, so maybe we could talk about that too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last row.
Well, I just know that the compact stars are really high mass related to their radius, like very dense matter, and the end game of the stellar evolution, the end points of the stellar evolution, like neutron stars are quite dwarf maybe, and I attended as well the Roman Gold's lecture last semester, so I think I will learn more about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So as a last part of my hopefully master's thesis will be about neutron stars, I try to get a deep understanding of those especially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I also expected to learn about neutron stars, the equations of states of stars, and maybe some strange stars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm excited to see or to learn about matter. Or how matter behaves under conditions where gravity is not relevant anymore or not neglectable, as is the case for dense objects or compact stars, as far as I know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I would also learn about neutron stars, black holes, and condensed matter.
Mm-hmm. So you came later and we missed you.
So what was the question?
The question is, what do you expect from the course? What kind of topics?
Well, according to the topic, I would say something more about neutron stars, or maybe even beyond this, which is not yet understood, just theoretical concepts.
Mm-hmm. Good. So I had heard a broad range of topics: white dwarfs, neutron stars, quasars, pulsars, even condensed matter physics. So let's see what we can cover. Two more things about you can contact me all the time. If you have questions about the lecture, you can send me an email or come by my office. So I'm in room 2.135. Okay. You can also ask that gentleman over there. This is Andreas Zacki. He's a postdoc working on compact stars. So if you have questions, you can also ask him. So he will be assisting me in these lectures. What is it, 3.6?
Yes.
Yeah, 3.6. Okay. Okay. Yeah, and the email addresses or telephone number you find also on here on the web page. Okay. Good. Okay, so let's start. So first I would like to start on what do we have on textbooks on compact star physics you want to look up. So I have been in contact with the librarian. She was checking up the textbooks, and some of them are missing and some of them will be replaced. So this is in progress. So there are several textbooks. Actually, the first one which I would like to mention is the one from 1934. And that is by Tolman. So already there, textbooks on compact stars appeared. So why do I quote this textbook? Because it contained already the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation in some sense. So this was in the textbook of Tolman in 1934. It's now in repress by Penguin Books or so. You can get it. There's another classic by Chandrasekhar himself from 1931. So let's write this down. Textbooks. So here we have the really classics. So this is Tolman himself from 1934. It's called Relativity, Thermodynamics, and Cosmology. I will put the PDF file of this list of textbooks in the e-learning platform. Then there was Chandrasekhar himself, who has written down in 1930 the Chandrasekhar limit, and in 1939 he published a textbook about this, Introduction to the Study of Stellar Structure, University of Chicago Press. Then there's another classic by Harrison, Thorne, Vacano, and Wheeler. This is a small booklet, 1965. As you can see, this is Kip Thorne. Yeah, who got the Nobel Prize for the detection of gravitational waves. And this is John Wheeler, who coined the term black hole, basically. 1965. This was intended to be a review article, but they worked so hard on it that eventually became a little book. So this is now a little book. It's also, all of those are actually in the library, so it's just nice to see. The interesting thing about this one, while this is about GR, this is about basically a limiting mass of white dwarfs. This one is basically the first one which discusses in detail the equation of state. So in particular, the Harrison-Wheeler equation of state was among the very first one developed in the mid-60s and used for a long time. And it has many goodies in it, so stability analysis and stuff like that is already contained in this textbook. And there's another one by Zeldovich and Novikov. This is from 1971. Also, this textbook is available in the library. It's called Relativistic Astrophysics. So in relativistic astrophysics in the 60s, 70s, this was the golden age of black holes, neutron stars, pulsars were discovered. And relativistic astrophysics is still prominent as a topic, for example, in the Texas Symposium, which is happening all over the world now, year after year. Relativistic astrophysics is astrophysics where relativity plays a role. Yeah? And this textbook is from Zeldovich and Novikov. Zeldovich is one of the most prominent theoretical figures from Russia, who has basically dominated the field in the 60s and 70s about relativistic astrophysics in all kinds of aspects. I mean, he has worked on many, many fields. Yeah? And he has established a group working on relativistic astrophysics, Zeldovich. So these are the classics. Okay, now the more recent ones. So more recent ones. I mean, 1971 is probably before all of you were born. And we have more recent ones. So there are two textbooks which I recommend, really, which you can use also as side reading to the lectures, because they are not monographs. They are really textbooks with exercises. They give a nice introduction to the area for beginners. And then I come to the more advanced ones. So this is the one by Shapiro and Tucholsky. In a certain sense, this is also a classic one because this appeared in 1983. But it emerged basically from lectures given by Shapiro and Tucholsky over several years. So it contains a lot of stuff, including black hole physics and accretion physics. So I have one copy here with me. So this is this textbook here, Black Holes, White Dwarfs, and Neutron Stars, The Physics of Compact Objects. So a lot of material. And the other one I would like to introduce to you is the one by Norm Glendening on compact stars. There's a second edition which appeared in 2000, which has additional chapters. And both these books are available in one form or the other in the library, but there will be replacements. So there will be at least two copies of those two available in the library. If you want, you can have a look at those books in the break. So we will make a break somewhere in the middle, 5 minute break. Okay, so this is Glendening. And the second edition was, I think, from 2000. Glendening, Compact Stars, yeah. Second edition. Okay, Norm Glendening. Good. Then there are other ones which are more advanced and are monographs, like the one by Fridolin Weber, Pulsars as Astrophysical Laboratories for Nuclear and Particle Physics, which appeared in 1999. The one by Kamenzind, he was a professor in Heidelberg, Compact Objects in Astrophysics, White Dwarfs, Neutron Stars, and Black Holes, which appeared in 2007. And the one by Hensel, Potikin, and Yakovlev. These are really experts in the field. In particular, all of them have done major contributions to the field of compact stars. And it's called Neutron Stars 1, Equation of State and Structure, which appeared also in 2007. And I missed one book, which has not appeared yet. And I just finished writing a textbook, which is submitted to Cambridge University Press and will hopefully appear in a few months. And the whole lecture will be based on this textbook. So, so hopefully. Hopefully 2020. I hope 2019, but maybe it takes more months. Okay. Good. So these are about the textbooks. Any questions about the textbooks? Yeah?
Will there be an exam or oral writing?
If you want to have the CPs graded, one can do an exam which will be graded. The exercises itself will not be graded. So there will be no exam, oral exam, unless you ask for a grade. Any more questions? Okay, so content. So first of all, we need an introduction, and here we will lay out some astrophysical concepts for compact stars and compact objects. So we'll be talking about compact objects, which are black holes, neutron stars, and white dwarfs. And we talk a little bit about stellar evolution, which is a key part for understanding compact objects, stellar evolution. So by the way, who has been listening to a course on astrophysics, astronomy 1 and 2? Oh, most of you. Okay, good, thanks. Good, so this will be an introduction. This shouldn't take too long. Then we have one longer section where we recap the essentials of general relativity. Yeah, so here the focus will be on explaining key concepts. So we were talking about equivalence principle, the strong, the weak, and the Einstein equivalence principle. We will talk about the Tolman and Oppenheimer-Volkoff equations, sketch the derivation quickly, and certain limits, certain bounds, like the Schwarzschild limit, for example, for compact stars. Okay, so this will be about, we will also do a little bit special relativity to start with. Has anybody attended a lecture on special relativity? So. Special relativity, Einstein equation, the Schwarzschild metric. Schwarzschild metric, then the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation. And Buchdahl limit, Schwarzschild limit, you will see. Okay. The other ingredient we need to understand compact stars are the properties of dense matter. So this will be the next chapter, will be about dense matter. Yeah, here we'll talk about matter in thermodynamic equilibrium, chemical potentials, beta equilibrium, equation of state, and so on. Equation of state of degenerate gases, and equation of state of interacting fermions, and I just write it, shot it down like this. Okay. So, and finally, we put everything together. So if you combine general relativity with the properties of dense matter, we come to compact stars. stars. So we will talk about spheres and hydrostatic equilibrium. We talk about maximum masses of compact stars. Already at that stage, without revoking really highly sophisticated models, we can make some generic comments about the maximum mass of compact stars with the knowledge we have here from those basic chapters. We're using Landau's argument for maximum masses. So let's write down Landau mass, which is based on Landau's argument, how to get a simple expression for the maximum mass of compact stars. We're talking about scaling solutions, quite generic. Scaling properties, scaling solutions. And then equation of state, limiting equation of state, causality. Limiting equation of state and the corresponding compact stars and self-bound stars. Self-bound stars, as you will see, are stars which are bound just by itself, as the name says, and they don't need actually GR to be bound. So usually if you have a neutron star or a white dwarf, you have an outward pressure, which is balanced by the inward pull of gravity. And this is not the case for self-bound stars. They are bound by themselves. And boson stars will be also part of this chapter. So chapter 5 will be about white dwarfs. Here we cover up the classics, the brief history of white dwarfs. We're talking about polytropes. Yeah, this is how Chandrasekhar actually came to the maximum mass of white dwarfs by looking at polytropes, the Lane-Emlyn equation, the Chandrasekhar limiting mass will be derived in detail. Yeah. And then structure of white dwarfs, thermal effects and observation of white dwarfs. Structure of white dwarfs. Good. Then we come to pulsars. So has anybody heard something about pulsars? Yeah?
Yes, there's just neutron stars there. Is it aligned in the right way in the sky so we can get some light off this what's this, axis?
Rotational axis.
Yes. Is there a right aligned on the sky so maybe we can see the pulse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
So it's mainly a neutron star which is spinning very fast and has a magnetic force which is kind of doing swirls.
Mm-hmm.
At least that is what you think, and ejecting a jet. And the jet is off axis, so it's like a lighthouse spinning.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see at very regular distances, we see this pulse. And for example, with double pulsars, you can measure how the distance changes if it moves along a very dense object.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very relativistic object. And
mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
Any other comments? No, this was fairly complete. So pulsars are rotation-powered neutron stars which have like a lighthouse, this beam which crosses the Earth and gives a regular pulse, very irregular ones. So we will first of all discuss the history of pulsars, how they were discovered. Does anybody know how pulsars were discovered or who discovered pulsars? It did the same too again, okay. Yeah.
She worked for some professor that was not so nice because he got all the credit for it, I think. And they searched for, I'm not sure if they searched for signals in the sky for alien life, but they find a regular signal, so, oh, what can it be?
Mm-hmm.
And no, it just was a star corpse.
It was what?
A star corpse. It pulls nothing else than a star corpse, or?
Mm-hmm. Star corpse. Yeah.
She was named Jocelyn Bell. She discovered them, and at the beginning they thought, well, it could be some military technology or something.
Mm-hmm.
But then they found it to be too regular to mm-hmm. be anything on the Earth. So they said, okay, it has to be some structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was discovered by Jocelyn Bell as part of her PhD thesis, as already mentioned, and Tony Jewish was the supervisor, and he got a Nobel Prize, I think, in 1993 or so for the discovery of pulsars. Yeah. And it was discovered in 1967. Okay. And actually, it was a serendipitous discovery. It was not meant to be discovered. They were looking for something completely different. But then they found this regular radio pulses. And yeah. That's how it came about. So, okay. So we're talking about properties of pulsars so far. The dipole model of pulsars and the characteristic magnetic field, the characteristic age of pulsars, rotational energy loss, the pulsar diagram. So also for pulsars, one can define a diagram like the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram for stellar evolution. One can do the same for pulsars, the pulsar diagram, the breaking index, pulsar glitches, dispersion measure, and neutron star masses, of course, most of all, masses of pulsars, which give a limit or some insight into the properties of neutron stars by measuring masses of pulsars very precisely. Okay, and also the double pulsar, which was mentioned, will be part of this section, which give one of the most precise tests of general relativity in the strong field limit. So then finally, we come to neutron stars itself. So while this is merely observationally, with some simple models how to explain those properties of pulsars, here for neutron stars, we are going now deep into the core of a neutron star by going down layer by layer. So we start with an outer crust. So structure of neutron stars, where we have outer and inner crust. And then this part of the outer and inner crust and part of the outer core, we will discover actually many features which you normally find in solid state physics. So we will have superfluid phases, we will have superconducting phases, we will have vortices, we will have lattice structures. So we will have crystals which are forming in the outer crust of neutron star. And we will also find pasta in the crust. Yeah, I will come to this, pasta in the crust. You know, pasta. So outer and inner crust, outer and inner core. So while we have some knowledge about equation of state for the outer core, we basically know nothing about the inner core, which is still under investigation under various groups worldwide. What is the property of the very inner core of a neutron star and how it can be probed by pulsars or by gravitation wave measurements, for example. Out in inner core. So, for example, we will talk about exotic matter, which might be present in the inner core of a neutron star. Most of all, these are either Bose condensates, then again we have some solid state physics again, or might be in the form of hyperons, which are strange neutrons basically. Neutrons with peculiar properties, hyperons. Then in principle, one can think that if we have reached such high densities in the core of a neutron star, probably the neutrons and protons melt and release the inner constituents, which are quarks. So the chapter 8 will be about quark stars. Yeah, so before we start, we will recap a little bit about QCD, quantum chromodynamics. QCD. The basic features of QCD, which is asymptotic freedom, running coupling constant, quark and gluon condensates, on that level. What we know about the interaction of quarks and gluons going to lattice data, so lattice QCD, which solves the QCD Lagrangian on supercomputer lattice QCD. And then we talk about strange quark matter and self-bound stars. So we will find actually in this chapter here, quark stars, there is room for self-bound stars when we talk about quark stars. Not for neutron stars, there are arguments that neutron stars can itself, by ordinary matter, cannot be self-bound. But quark stars in principle could have the feature that they are self-bound. It's not ruled out yet at present. Good. That is about quark stars. Then we have two more chapters. And I'm running out of space. So chapter 9 will be about hybrid stars. So basically those stars have two types of fuel. Literally, they're not running on this fuel, but they're stabilized by two different matter components. One would be ordinary neutron star material, and the other one would be quark star material, and that's why they're called hybrid stars. So this is basically neutron star plus quark star together is a hybrid star, in quotation marks. Yeah. So we are talking about piecewise polytropes. We're talking about particularly about phase transitions. So this will open the possibility that there might be phase transitions, either a sharp crossover, first order or second order phase transition. Again, we are coming back to solid state physics or something like this, phase transitions. Our QCD phase diagram. So the underlying theory of neutron stars and quark stars is QCD, of course, quantum chromodynamics. Yeah. So we can talk about, for arbitrary temperatures and densities, what are the phases of QCD? That's called a QCD phase diagram, and then can look, does it have any implications for compact stars, for hybrid stars? We're talking about Maxwell construction, Gibbs construction, and pasta in a core, and twin stars. Twin stars, a new family of solution which appeared of the Tom and Oppenheimer Volkoff equation once we have a phase transition present in the core of a hybrid star. And the last chapter will be about gravitational waves. And the reason is that many aspects of gravitational waves are related to compact stars, neutron stars, with a black hole, and those gravitational waves which were seen, the events we have seen in 2015 were two merging black holes, and there was one event in 2017 where two neutron stars merged, and one has recorded the gravitational wave signal, and also optical signals, which give an interesting input to gamma ray physics, for example, and the associated phenomena. So I will give a brief introduction into linearized gravity. as said before, would be beneficial if you have listened to a lecture on GR, but we will recap the essentials. So maybe by then you already have covered that topic also in your GR course, which you might also attend as a side course to this one. Then we talk about how the energy of gravitational waves can be calculated, how gravitational waves are produced. We're talking about Einstein's quadrupole formula and make quick estimates about the amplitude of gravitational waves to be expected from the various sources. And most importantly, for neutron star properties, we're talking about neutron star mergers. And what we can learn about the properties of neutron stars from neutron star mergers. There's already from the last event, we have one limit, which is called the tidal deformability. And that sets a limit on the compactness of a neutron star, a rather stringent one. And we will derive explicitly how to get this ellipticity from neutron star mergers. Particular. Good. So, a long list, a lot to do. Any questions about the content of the lecture? Too much information at once, yeah? The Kerr metric, we will not look into the Kerr metric when we talk about GR. That would be Kerr black holes. In principle, one can also look at rotating neutron stars. Unfortunately, this would be a separate chapter, which I had to omit because of time and space, also for the textbook.
Will this one be in your textbook?
No. No. The textbook was already, I had a page limit, and these 10 topics already filled up the page limit pretty precisely. I think I had 350 pages, and I got 347. So yeah, but rotation would be one to be included maybe in the next edition or in the forthcoming second volume or something like this. There's also cooling is missing, for example, cooling of neutron stars. A supernova is missing. How supernova physics, how do I really produce neutron stars? Hot neutron stars, proto-neutron stars are missing, unfortunately, so there's still a lot to do. A lot more can be added, yeah. Some of the stuff is discussed in the other textbooks, which are written here. So if you are interested in rotation, Glenn Denning talks a little bit about rotation. If you want to know more details about rotation, it will get very soon very ugly and complicated if you write down the full equations in GR for rotating objects. Also numerically, it will be hard to solve. It has been solved numerically. There are even codes available. There's a limit. There are approximations, the Hartley approximation, for rotating neutron stars, which one can use for slowly rotating neutron stars. For the full details, I refer to the textbook by Fridolin Weber, who has a whole section on this. Other questions? Okay, so you can think about it during the break. There are the two textbooks lying there. We will have a 5-minute break and then start after the break with the introduction.
Yeah.
Die ganze Diskussion ist immer an Waren.
Ja, aber da sind ja die sichere Scheibe drumherum.
Boah, Alter.
Nee, wirklich.
Das sind Grundsterne mit der Akkretionsscheibe, sind auch keine Knochen.
Die Akkretionsscheibe ist ja klein. Das hat ja ganz andere Ausmaße. Das weißt du auch selber.
Ja, ich weiß es, ich bin ja fucking groß.
Ja, also, das ist glaube ich
die
ganze
Galaxie. Ohne das zentrale Platz, was sind denn die
Das ist so zufällig, ja, aber dann geht es ja immer nicht mit Sternen auf.
Nee,
das hat nichts damit zu tun. Das ist da schon ziemlich
eigentlich schon da.
Nee, das ist das Problem. Man weiß nicht, was zuerst ist, aber die Galaxien sind schon zu low. Man weiß nicht, ob die Galaxien sich im schwarzen Löcher sind. Das schwarze Löcher sich in der Mitte von ausgezeichnet.
Ja, Leon ist alle Probleme in der Physik.
Jetzt noch der Zentrum.
Cedric ist halt jetzt natürlich ein. Sonst noch das Programm im Praktikum. Belegen, weil man da lernt, man noch Shell bedient. Natürlich versucht das so gut, das heißt, dass da das Computer das alles geht, bevor
ich
glaube
ich auch. Ja, es macht jetzt nicht ehrlich. Das ist auch für mich
schlecht entscheidend. Ja, ist das ja auch. Ich glaube, lieber morgen zusammen.
Vor allem lieber in der Welt selber zu lernen. Was hätte ich echt nur mehr Arbeit.
Geh doch halt stattdessen morgen, dann hast du die Hamilton-Parallel.
Ja, da wollte ich auch mal reinziehen. Das ist Mittwochs nach dem.
Und zwar?
Den hast du für 6 Stunden
gemacht. Oder verpasst die Übung?
Ja,
die Übungen sind ja am 11.
Ja, die Übung fängt ja erst nächste Woche an.
Ja, aber die Verpassung geht ja nur nach dieser Woche. Stattdessen zu einer Vorlesung, in der du C++ warst.
Ihr seid echt wahnsinnig gut freundlich. Hä?
Ehrlich, unsere Meinung ist es wirklich nicht sinnvoll. Du machst 18 für 4.
Und
lässt
dann da sagt einer,
weil du zu wenig Zeit hast.
Das ist so ein
bin schon fragwürdig. Dein Professor, von dem du viel gehört hast.
Du solltest jetzt nicht deine Mehrzeit am 18 zu machen. Und 4 dafür zu bekommen, ist ja ein bisschen scheiße.
Und es ist echt nur für 4 ein.
Ja. Ja. Der Journal Club wieder aber 2 Stunden.
Das wäre
Oberkühl,
das ist
doch
beides
für den. Ich weiß nicht, was du das weißt, aber der Journal Club ist 2 Stunden. Als Pro-Seminar ist 1 Stunde.
Ich sehe nicht vor,
ja, aber trotzdem.
ich das dann verwechsel.
Ich gebe der Person, die du als erstes hinzugefügt hast, ab, wenn ich da gekommen bin. Ich habe mir auch
so gedacht, okay, let's start with the lecture. Introduction, a little bit about stellar evolution, properties of compact objects.
Introduction.
So, compact stars are white dwarfs and neutron stars. In my lecture, it will be more generic. Compact stars could be also built up of some exotic particles which we have not discovered yet, fermion stars, boson stars, so something which consists of matter. While black holes are vacuum solutions of the Einstein equations, so that in principle, by definition, do not contain any matter in the sense of what we know from GR plus quantum mechanics. So, and they are the endpoint of stellar evolution. So we have a compact objects, and these are endpoints of stellar evolution. So let's start with the white dwarfs. So white dwarfs are the endpoint evolution of what? How do I produce white dwarfs in the universe? Yes, stellar evolution, yes, but how?
Small stars die.
Small stars die.
Yes, they don't have enough U to keep this equilibrium up.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's.
So, which small stars? How small?
Or
sun-like stars.
Pardon me? Sun-like stars. So you want to give an answer? Or no?
Answer straight.
No?
Sorry.
Yeah?
I think the limit is about 8 solar masses.
8 solar, perfect, yes. Great. So if a star has a mass which is below about 8 solar masses.
And I think this is the initial mass of the star.
That's right. So do you know what the acronym is for the initial mass of the star?
Zero
H main sequence star. This is the zero H main sequence of the star, right? So this is the mass of the star when it starts to do stable hydrogen burning on the main sequence. Then afterwards you have huge mass loss by stellar winds. So when they eventually collapse to a white dwarf, the white dwarf has masses which are well below 8 solar masses because most of the mass is just emitted away into the interstellar region. Yeah? Okay, so our sun would be included, and of course there is a lower limit on the mass of the star, so we will come to this. So what about neutron stars? How do I produce neutron stars?
What does SAMS mean?
SAMS? SAMS.
The same thing, the
Yeah?
The same thing, the coordinates to have at least...
Let me answer her question first, and then you can answer them. So the question, this is zero H main sequence. It's an acronym from stellar evolution theory. Okay, so now back to neutron stars. You wanted to say something?
Needed to have at least 1.44 solar masses, or was it another limit?
This is another limit. This is a Chandrasekhar mass limit. No, we already have here 8 solar masses. So what do we need? How do we produce neutron stars?
Basically, a star that has at the beginning more than 8 solar masses.
Mm-hmm.
It also needs to have not too much mass, because otherwise you will collapse into a black hole.
Right. So we will have then also black holes. So we need a more massive star to start with, but not too massive. So M star SAMS is about 8 to, and that upper limit is not well known, because even in the ideal cases, we need basically to know the equation of state of neutron stars to be sure what the upper limit is. And then there comes rotation into the game, magnetic fields, convection, can be utterly complicated, metallicity of the progenitor star, so the composition of the star when it collapses. This could, in either case, with the same mass, go into a neutron star, in the other case, it goes to a black hole. So this is 8 to, say, 25 solar masses thereabout, something like this, 20-25. Okay, and here for black holes, how do we produce black holes? Now, from stellar evolution theory, 25 solar masses. Okay, so they are really the end point of stellar evolution. Yeah, this is how they come about. Of course, there are other ways to produce black holes.
If the mass is too high, it should not produce a black hole at all, because fusion reignites and it disrupts the entire star, so we don't have anything left. I think it was above 230 solar masses so far.
Ah, there's an upper limit to
there's
an upper limit to black holes, so stars cannot be heavier than, you said, 230.
Some
other people say 100 solar masses, so it's rather uncertain, but there are electron-positron pair production, and they destabilize the stars, so more massive stars cannot be produced, do not have stable hydrogen burning. Therefore, there will be also a limit on these black holes, and therefore they are called stellar black holes, stellar mass black holes. Yeah. Of course, we know other black holes, and they are produced in a different way. What are the other production mechanisms for black holes? Yes?
There are supermassive black holes.
Yes, supermassive black holes.
Billions or even billions of solar masses.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know how they come to be, but they are very old. And
yes.
And there is a class between them that are the center of dwarf galaxies that are sometimes called intermediate black holes.
Yes, intermediate.
Tens and hundreds of thousands of solar masses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so here we have talk about masses. You said billions, right? 10 to 6 to 10 to 9 solar masses. And intermediate ones. What do you would consider intermediate ones? 1,000 or so?
I think about 10,000, something like that.
10,000, 10 to 4.
Yeah.
Roughly, okay, good. And stellar mass black holes? Okay, there's a limit here. Maybe from 100, but they are, of course, mass loss. So those black holes which come from this core collapse supernova simulations usually also have maybe a few solar masses at most, not more. Yeah. Okay.
But in the case of supermassive black holes and intermediate black holes, it's not the star's mass, so it's the object's mass, right?
Mm. Yes.
It's not the progenitor which has 10 to the 6 mass.
Yeah, this is the mass of the progenitor star. The masses of white dwarfs, neutron stars, and the black holes which emerge from that are entirely different. I will make a table. We will make a table of this one. So first of all, so white dwarfs, neutron stars, black holes have been observed. We know even several classes of black holes. We have even seen a picture of a black hole, right? What is the name of this black hole? You even have a name? Yeah. Okay. M87 star, right? We have seen a picture of a supermassive black hole. Yeah. Stellar mass black holes, we have also some indirect evidence from the gravitational waves, right? So which mass range do we have seen in gravitational waves for stellar mass black holes?
30 to 60
30 to 60 solar masses there about. Okay. Yeah. And there are black hole candidates in our galaxies. Any black hole candidates? Sometimes they're also called mini quasars.
I think Cygnus X1.
Yes.
It should be one of the strongest red houses on the sky.
Mm-hmm. Cygnus X1, so these are X-ray active systems which you can see in X-rays. They have a small accretion disk around the black hole, and a small one. Therefore, they are called mini quasars, and the quasars are supermassive black holes with an accretion disk. Yeah. Like M87 star also has this accretion disk, which is the, what you see on the picture. This the ring of fire is basically the accretion disk, the hot accretion disk. Actually, not so hot accretion disk around the supermassive black hole. Okay, so we can define certain properties of those remnants. So we can define a mean, an average mass density, which is well defined for white dwarfs and neutron stars. So rho bar is defined as 3m over 4 pi r cubed. Yeah. We can define, of course, a mass and radius. And from the mass and radius, we can also define a surface gravity. How is surface gravity defined, G, in generic terms? Newton's law?
Yeah.
Oh, a long time ago. No. That was different life, yeah.
Pardon me?
Yeah.
What's surface gravity?
Okay, we will do it as an exercise. No, I'm just kidding. Huh? You got it? Come on.
Yeah, you
got it.
G, M, under.
Over.
Over.
Just this one away, and then we have A and.
Okay. GM over R squared. So this is how they define the surface gravity. Okay. Of course, this is a Newtonian, basically a Newtonian concept. It can be made also in GR. We have a terminology of surface gravity, which is the kappa. So if you have some advanced course on GR, one can also define surface gravity for black holes, which is a kappa, which is 1 over 4 GM for black holes. We also can define a surface gravity, which is kappa, which is defined as 1 over 4 GM for Schwarzschild black hole, for Schwarzschild black hole, yeah. Kappa, okay. Good. What else can we look at for properties of compact objects? We can look what is called the compactness, and that will be a key quantity which we discuss in terms of compact stars. How compact is the object? And compact means basically how strong are effects from general relativity? How close is it to the Schwarzschild radius? We need to do. So the compactness C is defined as GM over R, and I put in C squared here to have the units right in SI units. And the Schwarzschild radius is defined as, who knows the definition of the Schwarzschild radius?
Yeah. 2 G and M squared square, not n squared, but over c squared.
Over c squared. Yes, so this is the Schwarzschild radius. And as you can see, if we plug this in, if we have a Schwarzschild black hole, which is non-rotating, the compactness of a black hole would be a half. And for a Kerr black hole, a limiting at the limit, rotating at the limit of a Kerr black hole, the event horizon, the radius of the event horizon is gm, so the compactness would be 1 for a Kerr black hole. And of course, we a neutron star or a white dwarf or any other object consisting of matter can never reach limits of a half, just for black holes or higher. So we already know compactness must be smaller than a half for neutron stars and white dwarfs. Yeah, otherwise, it would collapse to a black hole. Yeah, we would be, all the stuff would be in the interior of the Schwarzschild horizon. We cannot look at it from the outside, so we just measure the mass by a probe outside, and it looks to us like a black hole. Okay. Good. So let's make a table of the masses of black holes, neutron stars, and white dwarfs we know so far for those quantities. Okay, so let's start with the Earth. Earth, we have the mass of the Earth. And then the radius. In kilometers, and the compactness, C, the surface gravity, G, and the mean density, rho bar. Okay.
What do you put the mass in? Solar masses or? What's the unit for the mass? Kilogram, solar masses.
What's the unit for the mass? Kilogram. Oh, you want to do it as an exercise? No, no, we do it together. We do it together. Right? So what's the mass of the Earth, either in kilogram or in solar mass units?
It's 1/330 solar masses is the Earth.
1/300
solar masses.
No, that's maybe this is maybe Jupiter, but not the Earth.
Yeah. 6 × 10²⁴ kilograms.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's 6 × 10²⁴ kilograms, which is more in the range of 10⁻⁵ times the mass of the Sun, which you can write down just below. So what's the mass of the Sun?
One solar mass.
Pardon me? One solar mass. Yes, that's it.
1.98 × 10³⁰.
Okay, 2 × 10³⁰ kilograms. Okay, 1.988. Yeah. Okay. One can even give precise numbers. So. Yeah. Okay, we don't want to have it that precise. Okay, the radius of Earth is. About? Roughly. Rough number. 300,000. Which units? 300,000 kilometers for the radius of Earth. This is getting interesting. Okay. 1600 kilometers for the radius of Earth. Wow. 6,000. 6,300 kilometers. 6,700. Okay, the next time I have this hammer and I put in your, and you put, okay. So you got, okay, he got the answer. So 300,000 kilometers, come on. Yeah, the circumference, no. This is 40,000 kilometers. No. This is, okay, the radius of the Sun, this. 10⁷ kilometers, so 10 million kilometers.
No, 300.
You're cheating, you're looking up something.
No, I just.
No, okay, there's something in
700,000.
Seven, perfect. Seven, about 700,000 kilometers. So interestingly, it's just two orders of magnitude difference, yeah. And you can, as an ad memoir, the radius of Jupiter is just in between, is something about 7,000 kilometers. And from that, it's clear if you cube that one, that the mass of the Earth is something like 10 to the minus 6 times the solar mass, because the average density is higher, it's a little bit more. And the same holds then for Jupiter, which is about 10 to minus 3 solar masses. Okay, now we come to the compactness. So this is getting interesting because this is a measure of effects from general relativity for the Earth and for the Sun. And as an exercise, you're going to compute also the Schwarzschild radius of the Earth and the Sun. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, but first the compactness. The compactness. And there, either you know the number, which is probably small, but maybe you can guess what is the compactness of Earth. Some guesses.
I would say something very, very close to zero.
Very close to zero. How close?
Good question.
We are scientists. We want
to
have
10
to the minus 7. Okay. Anybody else? Effects from GR. And basically, those effects, the number I put down, are the effects, the relative effects of a GPS system, the precision of the GPS system, which relates to the compactness as a measure of relativity effects.
10 to minus
8. 10 to minus 8?
Minus
9. 10 to
minus 9?
Double. 10 to minus what?
12.
12? Okay. Good.
Smaller?
No, I have
16?
10 to minus 16. No, it's about 7 times 10 to minus. What I have? 10. 7 times 10 to minus 10. Some compactness. So the compactness of the Sun. I mean, you can basically make maybe a rough guess, but this is GM over R. Yeah, okay, a little bit difficult. But I have to look it up anyhow. So any guesses? A relativity effect. Basically, it tells you what is the gravitational redshift of the spectral lines we see from the Sun. Right? They will be shifted by this amount. Also, when we have a spectral line in Earth and measured from outer space, we'll be shifted by this amount, by 10 to minus 7 times 10 to minus 10, the spectral line. 10 to minus 6, yes. It's 2 times 10 to minus 6. So this will be the gravitational redshift of spectral lines of the Sun. It's measurable from the surface, right? That's always at the surface. What else do we have? Ah, surface gravity. Okay. Okay, as you had problems with how to get... Huh? Pardon me? So what's the surface gravity of Earth?
1g.
1g. 1g pi squared. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's, I'm using SI units now, 9.8 meter per second squared.
Are we talking at the equator or at the poles?
Okay, you want to have a precise number? I can give you the precise number, 9.80665. And this is the nominal Earth and nominal, how is it defined? Just defined as standard acceleration due to gravity. So it's really defined. That number is defined as the standard acceleration of Earth. And of course, you're right, if you go to the equator or to the poles, it will be slightly different. We even have anomalies on Earth where the gravitational acceleration changes from one place to the other. So of course, it's not that precise. So it's just, this is the definition. And for the Sun, surface gravity?
A power of 6 higher than that of Earth?
A power of 6, 10 to 6.
10 to 6.
No, not that much. No, that's 274. Point two.
The
yeah, and then we have that's the mean mass density in kilogram per cubic meters. I like this one. Average density of Earth. Any idea?
5 or 6.
5 or 6.
5,600.
5,600. So we have kilograms. So it's yeah. Okay, and for the sun, the mean density of the sun, the mean mass density?
Not so much.
Not so much?
It's just
guess. Guess? This is, I think, this number really interesting. You might have heard it in your astro lecture, the mean density of the sun.
40. Maybe.
40.
Is it too light?
40 kilogram per cubic meters.
Okay.
Or what, in kilogram or in gram? Yes, 40 kilogram per cubic meters.
Light.
Too light, so very diffuse, so very
400.
Light. 400.
400.
No. It's close to water, 1,410. Water would be 1,000, right? The mean density. Of course, if you look at the surface and compare to the center, in the center it will be 150 times the denser. That's because of this huge density profile we have in the sun. Okay, now comes the interesting part. We compare those numbers now to a typical white dwarf. And then to a neutron star and stellar mass black hole. Yeah. And here we define two ones, stellar on the supermassive one. Yeah. Supermassive black hole would be here. This would be a stellar black hole. Okay, so let's start. Mass of a white dwarf. Yeah?
Maximum
1.4 from the central Seca mass limit. And now observationally, what's the highest mass seen? Have we measured masses of white dwarfs? Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm.
And they are around. Any idea?
I think 1.2 is about
1.2?
1.1?
Yeah. So the measurement basically peaks around a half solar mass up to one solar mass. This is where most of the white dwarfs are seen. So write down 0.5 to 1 solar mass. Yeah. Now here we measure everything in mass units here. Solar mass units. Neutron stars. What are the masses seen for neutron stars? Yeah?
Up to two solar
masses and the lower limit?
The lower limit, I think it's 0.7 or something.
0.7 or something? So it's between 1 and 2. We will discuss this in detail, of course. Mass measurements of neutron stars, how do we know those masses? Also, we discuss masses of white dwarfs. Okay, that we discussed stellar black holes. Let's put in just a typical number. I put in here 10 at the order of 10 solar masses, and here we already said it's 10 to 6. To 10 to 10 solar masses. Right. Okay, radius of a white dwarf. Any idea how large is a white dwarf?
Around one Earth radius.
Yes, so it's about one Earth radius, so we're talking about 5,000 to 10,000 kilometers. 5,000 to 10,000 kilometers for neutron stars?
10 to 15 kilometers.
10 to 15 kilometers. Stellar mass black holes, okay, this would be the Schwarzschild radius. What's the Schwarzschild radius of a 10 solar mass black stellar mass black hole?
30 kilometers.
30 kilometers, perfect. And for the supermassive black hole, accordingly, a factor 3. Right, 3 times 10 to 6 to 10 to 10. Kilometers. Okay, and the compactness of a white dwarf, so the measure of relativity for a white dwarf?
0.1, 0.2.
This would be actually for neutron stars, we have 0.1 to 0.3. And for white dwarfs, we have at the range of 10 to minus 4. So one has seen redshifted spectral lines from white dwarfs. This has been used to measure actually the mass of white dwarfs or the radius. Okay, the compactness we discussed already for stellar mass black hole would be a half, 0.5, and also for this one would be 0.5. Surface gravity, okay, for a white dwarf. Hmm? Maybe I just put down the numbers. So for white dwarf, we already are talking about 10 to 6 meter per second squared. For neutron stars, we talk about 10 to 12 meter per second squared. And for stellar mass black hole, and here I take the surface gravity for a Schwarzschild black hole, and this is already also 10 to 12. And amusingly, for a supermassive black hole, the surface gravity gets smaller. So if you look at the surface gravity of a Schwarzschild supermassive black hole, it's 10 to minus 3 to 10 to 7. And you might have heard about the spaghettization effect. And so stellar mass black holes are much more dangerous than compared to supermassive black holes. If you fall into a supermassive black hole, you can pass the Schwarzschild horizon without getting too much disrupted. But if you encounter a stellar mass black hole, you are elongated like a spaghetti and distorted. So yeah, that reflects in the surface gravity effect here.
If you say that you can fly past the supermassive black hole Schwarzschild horizon without being affected, would you notice it, or would you just simply blip out of existence?
Will you notice if you pass a Schwarzschild horizon, you mean? You will not notice. Suddenly you're inside. There's no post marking, okay, now you're entering the black hole. You can also not tell it from your devices. Suddenly you see also that the only light which you cannot emit messages to the outside world anymore. So the outside world will realize, but you don't realize it immediately. Yeah.
But we do not really know what quantum effects do at the event horizon yet. So.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So about quantum effects on the surface, we can do some semi-classical treatments, and then we come to the effect of Hawking radiation, for example. Yeah. But of course, we do not know what is happening in the singularity, where we really have to talk about quantum gravity. Okay. Last point is the mean mass density of a white dwarf. So now, of course, there's no mass density here. So this is easy to answer. More interesting is what is the average density of a white dwarf and a neutron star. Anybody an idea what is the typical mass density of a white dwarf and a neutron star? In principle, you can guess, right? These masses are surprisingly close to each other. Yeah, which comes from stellar evolution somehow. Yeah? And the Sun is a typical star. So we have the same mass, but we have these different radii. So this radius is a factor of, is two orders of magnitude smaller with the same mass. So we cube this, so this is 10 to 6 times this. So this is 10 to 9, right? And here we even go down three orders of magnitude more. So this is 9 on top of this, so this is 10 to 18. Kilogram or 10 to 15 gram per cubic centimeters. Okay, any questions about this? No? Good. Good. So, still have some place here. So we have talked about masses and we have talked about radii. Okay. So maybe a little bit about where the names are coming from. So white dwarfs, the name comes from the fact that we have appear, they are hot actually. Hot, so they appear white in telescopes, in optical telescopes. Yeah, that's where the name comes from. And it was the first white dwarf which was discovered was Sirius B, companion star of Sirius A. Sirius B. So this is a companion of Sirius A. So Sirius A is the brightest star we see in the sky. And besides that, there's a small spot which you can only see with a high resolution. So it was only discovered in the mid of the 19th century by building a really big lens, the biggest lens at that time. And the lens was probed at Sirius A. And then they discovered there's a small spot there.
Do the companion of stars get disturbed if, for example, one is massive and goes through a supernova? Does the other, is this mostly far away that it doesn't really feel anything from the other star, or is the system also disrupted?
So the question was about if you have a supernova explosion and the companion star is a white dwarf, what will happen to the pure white dwarf? If it will be disrupted or not. So in some cases, the white dwarf will survive or will be just expelled from the system. And we know actually systems where we have a neutron star and a white dwarf orbiting each other. So somehow, neutron star came from a supernova explosion, the white dwarf from stellar evolution. So this can happen. They can survive. So this was first discovered. So this was an observational telltale signature. Now, neutron stars, on the other hand, were first postulated. Postulated first that they might exist, that we have balls of neutrons and they stabilize themselves by Fermi pressure and interactions, and then discovered later by serendipity. And the term neutron star was first coined by Bader and Zwicky. And Zwicky, this is the earliest incident I have seen that name in 1934 in an abstract for the meeting of the American Physical Society. And what they actually said is that, I will read it to you, with all reserve, we advance the view that supernova represented transitions from ordinary stars into neutron stars, which in their final stages consist of extremely close packed neutrons. And of course, the idea that there's a sphere of neutrons goes back to a paper which appeared in 1932 by Landau, where actually postulated the existence of neutron stars. And of course, they were aware of that paper. And so this goes back to Landau in 1932. He was a young postdoc at that time, and there are some more nice stories about it. At that time, he was a postdoc actually at the Niels Bohr Institute and talking with Niels Bohr about the possible existence of neutron stars, already in 1932. In 1932 was the same year where they discovered actually the neutron. Chadwick discovered the neutron. It was not known before. So, and black holes were characterized by on theoretical grounds. So before that, the concept was clear, black hole somehow was already in the solution of the Schwarzschild metric. So in the first solution written down by Schwarzschild in 1916, he already had basically the black hole solution written down with the Schwarzschild radius and whatever. And at that time, they talked about completely collapsed gravitational objects. And at some time, this was just too long. Already in the mid-60s, they were always talking about these completely collapsed gravitational objects. And so there's some nice book by John Wheeler, which is autobiographically in Nature, where he says that somebody in the audience coined this term black hole, and since then it stuck to everybody. But it really goes back to... Ah, okay. So there's another story which you mentioned, that some guy on a radio show somehow was mocking up some development, but this was not about black holes, this was about the term Big Bang. So somebody was making fun of the term Big Bang in a radio show, and then somebody, and then everybody else picked it up and said, okay, we're making Big Bang theory now. So this makes sense, right? So, and this was a quarrel between Gamow and Hoyle, Fred Hoyle. Fred Hoyle was the person who was coining this terminology. He was making fun of his colleague George Gamow, who was exploring this Big Bang theory. Of course, he didn't call it Big Bang theory at that time. And he argued that all the elements in the universe were produced in the Big Bang. And Fred Hoyle said, no, all the elements are produced in stars, in supernova collapse and stellar evolution. So he was making fun of this, Big Bang doesn't exist, I can produce all the elements in stars, and so this is how it came about. Later on, it turned out both were right. So some of the elements are produced in Big Bang, which cannot be produced in stars, and the rest of the elements are produced in stars. And Gamow was making a fun poem out of this, which is, well, maybe at some stage I should read it to you. Okay. So black holes. So this was coined, I write down Wheeler, because there's no account of the person who was saying that in the audience, and it's remembered by John Archibald Wheeler. So it was coined by Wheeler in the mid-60s, and it goes back to Schwarzschild, who has written down the first solution. Of course, at that time, he was not fully aware of all the implications which his solutions has, right? So he was simply writing down the first analytic solution of the Einstein equation. Karl Schwarzschild, who was actually born in Frankfurt, right? He was born in Frankfurt. Good. I have some more stuff, which will take some more time. So maybe I stop here, and then we talk about the details of stellar evolution on Thursday to finish up on this. So are there any questions about so far these properties and observations of black holes and neutron stars? Yeah, maybe I just quickly say that white dwarfs have been seen mainly within our galaxy. They have seen in the optical. We also see them as partners orbiting a sun, where they accrete material from a star, not a sun, where they accrete material from a star, and they give X-ray flares. Also, neutron stars can orbit an ordinary star, or can even orbit a white dwarf or another neutron star. And also, when a neutron star orbits an ordinary star, we have also X-ray flares, or even gamma ray flares. And they are also observed as pulsars. We also have seen isolated neutron stars. We will discuss this, streaking through the sky, so we can really see them in the telescope. So the Hubble Space Telescope has made a picture in the optical from a neutron star. And in principle, we can also see one when we look in M1. We see object M1 in the Crab Nebula. There in the very core of the Crab Nebula is a pulsar, which is a neutron star, rotation-powered neutron star. Yeah. Any questions from your side? Comments? It's not done yet, so I have to make it, the exercise sheet, and we'll put it online, and then we discuss. There will be no exercises this week. The exercise will start next week. Okay? Yeah. You're welcome.